Welcome to Equestrian Movement's First Do No Harm podcast. I'm your host, Katie Boniface, co-founder of Equestrian Movement with Sarah Gallagher. We work with horse riders who want to build a stronger bond and a deeper connection with their horses. In our First Do No Harm podcast, we discuss with other industry professionals how to work with horses to firstly do no harm and secondly support their mental, emotional and physical well-being throughout the training process, so that we have horses that enjoy learning and ask to be ridden. Each episode, we discuss the different influences our training can have and how we can improve our horses' overall athleticism, soundness of mind and body, and emotional fortitude, while strengthening and deepening our relationship with our horses. Each week, I will endeavour to bring to you a new episode on horse riding, training, handling and husbandry, or an interview with other industry professionals to help you address where and why you might get stuck in creating the beautiful union of dancing souls that is the equestrian sport. Are you ready to kick off today's show? Let's get started. Thanks for joining us for episode 3 with Dr. Andrew McLean. If you have missed the following weeks, make sure you go back to episode 1 and catch up on the whole conversation. Andrew has been sharing how he strives to modernize horse training with the latest scientific data on the natural behavior of horses, their learning processes, human and equine biomechanics, handler and rider effects, and attachment. He shares with us some enlightening information about the impact that riders can have on the quality of the development of the horses. When horse training is aligned with these elements, it becomes ultimately successful and safe, thus greatly improving horse welfare in the equestrian sport. Andrew's aim at Equitation Science International is to use the most effective teaching techniques to disperse this information around the world, and in doing so, liberate horses and riders from the trappings of tradition, mythology, and hearsay. Andrew brings a breath of fresh air to a dated system. As I say, Andrew was doing clicker training before it was cool. And we love having him share his experiences and his research here with you on the show. Make sure you check out the links in the show notes so that you can follow up with the work that Andrew is doing and check out the books and his online programs. Without further ado, let's kick off today's show.
As a coach and a trainer, a lot of what your work is done is driven by the wants and needs of the rider, and a lot of the wants and needs driven by the rider if they're competing is the assessment of the judges. And so, you know, I've competed all my life and come home with dressage tests full of rounder, deeper, more forward, and just being like, okay, and just like driven harder, ridden rounder, asked for more bend, gone into the next dressage test, rounder, deeper, more forward, more bend, and you're like, what am I supposed to do with this information, especially like when you're comparing a stock horse to a warm blood or a standard bred and a thoroughbred? Like, you know, you can't make those other breeds look like this warm blood breed, especially, you know, and it's not necessarily something that we want either with the way that we're training hypermobility into the warm bloods to try and create the look that the judges are going to reward for. And yeah, we're really losing the welfare and what it's supposed to be about. Like, all horses can have this fundamental and foundational way of moving for soundness, and that should be our goal, not like what somebody sees as aesthetically pleasing that is going to make the horse unsound long term.
Yeah, absolutely. There's, you know, even the front legs and back legs become a bit asynchronous. You know, we call it diagonal advanced placement, where a front leg might even touch the ground before a back leg, which is really unusual in a horse. It's not part of their normal movement. And often it happens because the central pattern generator, this neural oscillators in that spinal cord, become compressed because the neck is too short. And, you know, I've seen these recent justifications for these things where people say, oh, well, you know, these modern horses, they're built to be really powerful, and they, you know, that's just how they are. They're just explosive energy. And, you know, I do understand a lot about the modern breeding, particularly the new sort of Dutch genetics that's coming, where they're much more flamboyant. But nonetheless, these horses are not driving themselves through fences when they're on their own. They're not showing power by having no brakes when they're on their own.
Yeah.
It's something to do with the interaction of humans. And therefore, if the horse is doing an extended trot and pushing on the bit really strong, that needs a downward transition in training and then release and say, are you staying in this speed? You shouldn't really get to any level extended trot that you cannot show self-carriage. You should be able, and plenty of people have done it. Rainer Klimke could do it years ago. And that's to me where we lost a lot of, that was a turning point of dressage. It could have got a whole lot better in his direction. And now it's just gone a whole lot worse because of roll curve. I've just been part of a group of scientists, and it's not published yet, but it's in press. It'll be coming out soon. It probably will be a bit of a game changer. It's a meta-analysis of hyperflexion. And we looked at 55 papers and we applied statistical methods to look at the sort of veracity of those, all different aspects of hyperflexion, what happens. You know, some papers were supporting it and most are against it. But what I found really profound, that really was a game changer for me, is that these very good robust studies show that when the horse is behind the vertical and the neck, you know, the angle of the neck, called the angle, that part there, is shut, the gullet is shut, there's a 12 to 15% reduction of breathing. In other words, they're having an asthma attack. It's like an asthma attack. So who in their right mind, unless you're a criminal, would think that's an okay thing to do in the name of animal sport? So, and then other studies have shown that even any amount of roundness begins to shut the airway minimally in the beginning. And of course they do it to themselves, they do this, but they don't do it for long and they don't train like that. They don't spend all their time practicing that. And then you see these hideous videos of horses being tied up in the stable with a shut gullet. And then I often wonder, what on earth are they thinking? Their horses clearly have thick wind. Like you can hear them, the way they move. You can hear the front legs heavier on the ground, sound like they should normally. And they just dismiss it and they keep on going. But the reason they do it is they're aiming for this goal set by judges.
Yeah.
The judges have to change. They have to start rewarding horses, not only in front of the vertical, but also demonstrating self-carriage. And I said this years ago, that in every movement as far as possible, riders should be asked to reach forward with the reins for just two steps. Two steps is fine because the horse won't lose outline any more than two, and he'll start to reach forward, probably unless he's really scared of the bit, and to check that the horse stays in the speed and stays in the gait and stays in the outline. And check on circles when you release your inside rein, does he stay on the circular line? Even check with the outside rein. Check with any rein. Take your legs away for two steps. Prove that you've trained this bird to sit on your arm and you're not having to hold on to its wings.
Yeah, so good.
It's just not training. It's actually
no.
not. It's actually no. All of wrestling and animal wrestling that needs... and. There's no evidence that the horse is up for this. The biggest problem for horses is that we have bred them to be so good at habituation. Mm-hmm. That's the only thing we've changed in selective breeding in terms of psychology. We've altered their habituation ability to the point where they'll tolerate almost anything to their own detriment. There's no way you could do that to an elephant. It'd kill you.
Yeah.
Even milder things they kill their mahouts for.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a show.
Yeah, we have a lot of work to do. Oh.
We have to spread those messages, though, because this is critical. And for me, often the horse people, when I start to write about these things, think, like, I'm going to shut horse sports down. I'm actually wanting to keep them open by getting people to change and see the writing on the wall and manage to go with it. There can always be horse sports. All you need to do is do it softer. Do it with a little bit more length of outline. Do it so that the horse is comfortable in the space that you give him and demonstrate it by releasing the reins. You'll still be okay to ride horses for at least some time. I wouldn't be fighting against any of that at all. I just don't like what I see. And it got worse.
And, yeah.
It got better for a while with people like Charlotte Dujardin with Vallegro, but it's not got better recently.
No, definitely. Yeah, there's a lot of work to do to make sure that we're staying on the right track and that the work that we are doing with the horse is not for ego and personal gain and ribbons and whatnot, but for the actual soundness mentally, physically, and emotionally for the horse. And you can say that a lot of what is being rewarded does not support that.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, and it just needs more voices, and it needs people to bat for the horse who really love horses to be on this and try and imagine what it's like to be a horse.
Yeah, so that was one of the other ones that I always like talking to animal behaviorists, because you will get, you know, so much in the like online spaces or social media and whatnot of like, stop anthropomorphizing the horse. And I love talking about that. It's like, where's that line of like empathy and anthropomorphization, if I can get it out of my mouth?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is empathy is a really important thing with animals. And I think that's really where most horse people come from, a position of empathy. They do feel that, but also the horse is relegated to object rather than subject in many cases, in the way the horse is used and described, you know, because people will go, empathy is a blurry line. I think it's not, you know, when you look back in human history, we haven't always been that empathetic anyway. You know, the way we've, the horrible ways we've treated other people, where as a society, we're possibly heading in a much better way now. But we need to think about that with our use of animals in sport. How would it be if we were in that, you know, in that position? And so when they anthropomorphize about the horse and they say, well, the horse loves to, you've got to really question, how do we know he loves it? You know, what are the really good tests of, I mean, they're really good at learning. So we train them, then the training becomes habitual, and they're very good at habituation to various contexts and whatever we do, as I said, to their own detriment sometimes. But we've got to remember that a horse is a horse. You know, he goes out in the paddock and he's still able to interact with all the others. And we need to be thinking about the horse as a horse. In many ways, like management, we need to move towards a direction of socializing horses better in stables. We don't need the bars above the stables. We can let them touch each other. It's not just something they like to do. They actually need it. It's built into them to do it. And of course, some will hold back because they're so messed up from early, we wean them too early, and from being restricted from other horses, that they're already neurotic. But if we want to have horses in their own normal function mentally, we need to not wean them so early. We need to socialize them and continually socialize them and allow them to touch each other over the walls. And I've mentioned this heaps of times, but you know, there's lots of evidence of how good that really is. I mean, there's lots of papers now supporting the importance of that kind of social stabling compared to isolating them. It's not enough to just see another horse. They are touchers. They're hypersocial. And the psychology journals in humans is full of problems of humans who are isolated. Isolation's a terrible thing. And in fact, isolation is the single most significant criterion associated with mental disease in humans. So, you know, we know that. We need to think that horses are also social. They're not a solitary animal. They never have been.
And it's a lot easier to have other horses teach your horse good social engagement skills rather than you trying to teach it yourself. Yeah. We aren't so good at how we're supposed to show up for the horse in those moments. And especially if you're scared of your horse at the same time, it's, you know, not only so much healthier for the horse and, you know, it's going to have that flow on effect of balancing the biochemistry that is going to be imbalanced when those needs aren't being met. But it also means that you don't have to necessarily be the one that's doing it either.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And that's really, I mean, that's important that they learn that. And, you know, it's amazing how one of my PhD students, Elke Hartmann, is now an esteemed ethologist. And her PhD many years ago was how to introduce horses into herds. And she had really large numbers of Swedish and Danish warm bloods, like I think up to 60 in each. So it was a very good study. And what she showed was new arrivals into with one other horse or a herd, you could get it to the point where it was safe by only half an hour at the most of interaction across the yard. So they've only got to sniff each other's first few interactions. You can let them in, and it looks like they're going to half kill themselves when they're in the yard. As soon as they're in with each other, they do a squeal and a snort, and they eat together usually. Occasionally they'll chase each other around, but if it's best in a larger paddock, but they'll have a bit of a run, and then they're okay usually. So
yeah,
there are a few examples where it hasn't worked out okay in very small paddocks.
Hmm.
And because there is, you know, the resource guarders, and it's not normal for them to have restricted resources because they're, you know, grazers and herbivores. But when we do feed them in a single feed bin, we just got to make sure that there's plenty of room for another horse to get out of the road.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's so valuable to have them like that. They need each other. And in a thunderstorm, an isolated horse is going to be way more at risk of going through a fence than a horse in a group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot to cover.
So many things. I honestly, like, I could talk to you for the rest of my life. I do have a student that wanted to put a question through to you. Her name is Heidi. She said that she's your biggest fan. She's so lovely. She also has bought your book for our students and for me. She loves your work as well and raves about you. And her question is about the way that, you know, you can see the padding is like an open-handed slap and it's actually an aversive to the horse, and why people do it, I guess, and, you know, why don't they understand that it's an aversive?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one. And thanks, Heidi. I appreciate your support. It is a really interesting one. And, I don't know where it came from, but I've got a suspicion that it's a very ancient thing, because when I worked in zoos, actually with elephants, more than 20 years ago at Melbourne Zoo, I did notice that chimps pat each other on the head. And I thought, this is where it all started.
We're all monkeys.
Yeah. And it's bizarre that people do. And children pat dogs. Of the often you see them do this, you know, on the dog's head, rather, but they'll also stroke. But it's also become an endemic thing as part of the, you know, the badge of honor for trainers to show to the public that, or to others, how much they appreciate their horse. But it isn't useful for the horse. The horse could learn patting as something that they want, as a positive reinforcement, if we paired it carefully with stroking. Like if you patted and then stroked, through classical conditioning, the horse might learn that. But on its own, and people don't usually do that, but on its own, patting, one of my students years ago, Emily Hancock, published a paper on this and showed that patting generally makes horses accelerate. So in other words, they're running away from it. It's interesting. It's probably not that much different to them than being tapped with a crop.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just a pointless kind of a reward that makes absolutely no sense to me whatsoever, but nonetheless people do it. And I think it's bizarre because stroking is so much better for them to do that. And there's an increasing amount of evidence for the use of stroking as a tactile reward. And that doesn't make them run away.
Yeah.
The study that she did was at Olympic horses after the dressage, that patting, you know, suddenly got to grab the reins.
Yeah. Oh, so good. Yeah, I could just keep talking to you all day, but I will be conscious of your time. If you're wanting to follow what Andrew's doing, he's amazing resources for you. As we've got, as we've been talking about, the book, the volume one of the First Principles, Modern Horse Training, Equitation Science Principles and Practice, is just such a handy little guide and book to have with you as you're working through your training. We'll have the link in the show notes. Andrew also has a diploma of equitation science that is online based. So if you're in Australia, that's fabulous because it's recognized by our government, but he's also able to host international students through that as well. And there's some beautiful principles being taught in that. And then you would be qualified, right?
Yeah, many of our students have got jobs with RSPCA and that sort of thing with this diploma because they recognise its importance. But in general, it just keeps you safe and you can go to a stable or wherever as a groom or as a trainer, and just handle horses in a much more effective way and get them calm to lead and stand still and all of those sorts of things, and all the basis of learning, teaching them under saddle without risking your neck. And incidentally, that book, Modern Horse Training, that you mentioned, that one there is basically the theory behind it all and the latest. So I think I would venture to say that it's certainly the most up-to-date textbook in the world at the moment, because our last major text, Equitation Science, we decided not to do a third edition of that at the moment. So this one is more recent than that. So that's Modern Horse Training, and also the practical part of that book. So part two will be out, I think, in about 2 months. So
I'm very excited for this.
We'll be making a statement on that through our ESI website, I think, and other Facebook things.
Beautiful. So all the links to the website and how you can continue to work with Andrew will be in the show notes. And any other places that you can follow the work that they're doing, maybe even if you wanted to watch some elephant stuff, put all the links to that in the show notes. Been an absolute pleasure talking to you today and sharing your time and your wisdom with us. You can really see, you know, how beautiful the work is that you do and so well referenced and studied, and just the wisdom exudes from you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this final episode of our conversation with Dr. Andrew McLean from Equitation Science International. We hope you've enjoyed this conversation as much as we enjoyed having it with Andrew. And we are so blessed and lucky for Andrew to offer to come back again on the podcast very soon. So if you have any questions that you'd like me to pose to him, let me know and I will pass them along. Jump on the links in the show notes to check out the resources that we've talked about within these episodes. We will have links to his books and his online program and his efforts with his welfare with regards to the elephants. If you've had any big gems or aha moments, make sure you share them on Instagram and tag us so that we can see what you're loving about these conversations. Until next time, happy trails. If you're starting to realize that escalating pressure and having pressure release is the only tool in your toolkit inevitably results in conflict and manhandling your 500 kilo plus fur baby, you have to check out our free masterclass, Say Yes to a Happy Willing Horse. There is an art and a science to everything we do with our horses. The science is the undeniable behavioral training and manipulation of the internal chemistry, neurotransmitters and hormones. Hello, dopamine. The art is in the connection and the relationship. How your horse behaves is a reflection of who they are in relationship to you, how they receive your instruction, and how safe you make them feel to follow your lead. And if you didn't want that, ride a motorbike. We know that our horses are emotive, intelligent, sentient beings that are aware of the manipulative, coercive, and sometimes abusive tactics used to force them to cooperate. And we can seek a better way. The foundations of holistic horse handling are nervous system regulation, compassionate leadership, communication, and emotional agility. These elements are critical to have a handle on before going to work with your horse, so that we can develop the psychological safety for the horse to communicate how the training can be of benefit to them. Our training should be happening for them, not to them. If we want a horse that we can have trust and confidence in and that seeks to look after us first, we need to create an environment where learning is fun, movement feels good, and our horses ask to be ridden. This sounds impossible to you, know that it's not. It's a reality hundreds of our students have achieved. It just requires coming home and a relearning of what we lost due to peers, coaches, trainers, and other influences teaching us that kind of softness and kindness creates unsafe horses. In truth, it is the opposite. To create safe, willing horses, we first need to create a felt sense of safety and a felt sense of belonging. We need to be strategic and intentional how we set the horse up for success so as not to overface ourselves and our horses, and we need to create experiences where we build trust and confidence in each other. If you're ready for your horsemanship and horse riding to look like this, take the first step. Click on the link in the show notes and join us in our free masterclass, Say Yes to a Happy Willing Horse. Or you can find it over on our website at www.equestrianmovement.com/say yes. Until next week, happy trails.